financial freedom my only hope. Of living rich and dying broke. I bought some artwork for $1 million. 2 years later, that wish worth $2 million. 2 years later, that wish worth $8 million.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's Jay-Z, the first billionaire rapper. Not because of his music, which is very profitable, but rather his investments. In his song, The Story of OJ, Jay-Z talks about financial literacy in part to show African-American youth how it works. For many African-Americans, financial illiteracy is a function of several factors, all of which revolve around the lack of wealth. 150 years ago, Black Americans owned one half of 1% of the national wealth. Today, they're at just over 1.5%. Ohio State basketball alumnus and former NBA player Lawrence Funderburk is now a certified financial planner. He joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Kelvin Schermerhorn teaches history, philosophy, and religious studies at Arizona State University. His 2015 book is titled The Business of Slavery and the Rise of American Capitalism, 1850 to 1860. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
That's pretty much where this sort of starts, about that time. We think of June 19th is called Juneteenth. It was the day of emancipation for African Americans in the United States. And people thought, all right, it might take a generation, but they'll catch on and they'll get their own wealth and off we'll go to the races, right?
Yes, that was that's kind of the mistaken history of this this process. And that is, what was hidden in those assumptions was the tremendous reluctance or hostility on the part of former enslavers to allow African Americans to rise by the, you know, rise to the extent of their talents. And so they quickly replicated things that mimic slavery, like sharecropping, which is essentially working on shares. The southern states quickly innovated a convict lease system in which African Americans, often convicted on trumped-up charges, were sent off to work camps and leased out to companies. And this had a tremendously powerful drain on resources.
Mimicked as in a serious way, even today, with the mass incarceration issue, the impact of being incarcerated, the impact on the larger family is devastating.
Absolutely. And, you know, being incarcerated, while it doesn't seem to have economic overtones, right, per se, a family with, you know, had a household or breadwinner who's incarcerated, even for a short amount of time, can be an economic life sentence, thanks to things like the box you check on an application saying whether you've been arrested or convicted of a crime.
Then there were more insidious, even more insidious things that occurred much later in time, and that had to do with redlining and the access to credit and banking.
Oh, yes, correct. This is the part that's a little bit tricky to understand. But when the federal government got into the business of in guaranteeing economic security, as so far as it does, the federal agency involved in guaranteeing private loans assessed parts of residential neighborhoods and cities, and they would grade these by color, green being the best and red being the worst. In red, it was almost always an African American, sometimes Jewish, Hispanic neighborhood, and then they would say these houses are ineligible for credit. And so what that meant was that lenders would be, you know, lenders would stay away and the neighborhoods would decay, often in parts of cities that are highly desirable today.
What did that do, the lack of ownership of property? That occurred during the very time when many Americans, well, the middle class was emerging, right?
Yes. And so if you think about what happened in the early 20th century, was that the United States got into the business of kind of adjusting incomes, adjusting wealth, and creating a huge middle class. And if we think of where most families' wealth comes from, it comes from home ownership. In fact, two-thirds of our wealth as a nation is in home ownership. So that really expanded starting in the 1930s, really got going in the 1940s and 1950s with suburban America. And so if you deny credit to people at the beginning of that great compression of wages, that great expansion of the middle class, then on those critical decades in the 1940s and 50s, when the middle class is growing, African-American families are being systematically excluded from that, because not only could they not afford, or they could not get the home loans, but then as those home values rose, as the suburbs grew, and the good schools became escalators to, you know, white-collar careers, then that prevents the intergenerational transfer of wealth and advantage.
Here's something that really gets to me that I didn't know about until the last few years, and that was the impact of the GI Bill. African-Americans, perfectly proportionate to their numbers, served in World War II. The GI Bill was established to help veterans regroup when they returned. What happened?
Yeah, so what happened was, here's another example of a wonderful federal program to say, get service personnel, men and women, into college. It's the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944. And that was another one of these escalators into the middle class. But since the programs were administered on a local level, you had, African-American veterans returning to Mississippi, for example, being systematically denied entry into even some of the historically black colleges and universities, while you had white servicemen coming back and streaming into flagship universities. They also, part of the GI Bill was mortgage allotments. And uh-huh. So in New York and New Jersey, right after the war, some 67,000 mortgages went out to service personnel, and only 100 went out to non-whites. They also steered veterans into job training programs. And in places like Mississippi, 90% of the African-American applicants were steered into serviced or non-skilled jobs, and something like 90% of the white applicants were steered into semi and skilled jobs.
And then, by the way, this is another shocker to me. Social Security at the time was limited who could get Social Security. So if you were a domestic laborer or a sharecropper, you were out of luck.
Correct. So, farm and domestic service was originally excluded from Social Security. And at the time of that act, about 90% of African Americans worked in those industries.
And as far as rural poverty goes, African Americans are far more disproportionately affected by it than whites.
Yes, and this is another part of the history that's reinforcing across time, and that is that since the 1940s, about a million African-American farmers have lost their land, millions and millions of acres, because of schemes that were often abetted by government agencies to take their land. We also see this in fraudulent tax sales and schemes to take land from black property owners across the country, but it was concentrated in the South, and this is a holdover from the Jim Crow era, where since the courts did not respect the rights of African Americans, there was a lot of predation by white neighbors who might come in and claim that there's a lien on the property, or they owed a debt, and a court would take the land. And so, yes, rural African America has some of the worst outcomes of any African American community.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We've just been going through a litany of reasons why African-Americans are so far behind the eight ball when it comes to wealth in this country. My guest, you just heard, Calvin Schermerhorn. He teaches history, philosophy, and religious studies at Arizona State University. His 2015 book is titled The Business of Slavery and the Rise of American Capitalism, 1850 to 1860. Also with us, Lawrence Funderburk. He's a certified financial planner. You probably know him as well. As an Ohio State basketball alumnus and former NBA player, Lawrence Funderburk, you're nodding your head through this litany, of course, but I can't imagine when you, as a financial planner with your clients who are African-American, I mean, every once in a while they come up and say, why is this? Do you find yourself relating these kinds of historical – can they see the forest through the trees?
I mean, there are a lot of historical implications that continue to this day to haunt us. I mean, even though we were emancipated, we were never actually freed. And free really deals with the issue of being able to move, having mobility, not just in terms of your physical body, but what about in terms of your financial lives? And I think one of the things that I've tried to do is help people – move and give them the skills and the tools that they need in order to achieve success. And I think, you know, when you talk about mass incarceration, when you talk about the lack of housing, you know, I tackle a lot of those issues. And I think for African Americans, we need to make it sensory driven. We need to touch it. We need to feel it. That's how we learn primarily. So I just did a workshop with a group of offenders who are going to be released back into society. And me and my wife produce these games. And what we do is there's a game called Reality Days, and we give folks a chance to buy a house or to rent an apartment. And what's amazing is mostly all of those guys, because their frame of reference has always been to rent, even when they have money, they choose not to buy a house in a hypothetical setting. And then they realize, when we look at the income statement and then we say, well, what is wealth? That is really the measure of your balance sheet. And we go to the second leg of that game. Then they realize, aha, if you have home ownership, that actually helps you build wealth. And you're right, we're way behind a ball. But you have to back up and say, let's look at some structural issues. Mm-hmm. Because I always say rehabilitation without excavation is a futile process. You mm-hmm. got to excavate. Just like the professor is talking about, really excavating, looking at some of the underlying currents here. We have to look at a lot of the broken, personal brokenness issue in the lives of these folks. So I say, well, what is really driving a dysfunction? What's driving a behavior? We really, really need to address that. And then also get them to take some baby steps. Heartland Bank is a bank that's really gotten behind me. I've had other financial institutions in Columbus here to get behind me. But Heartland says, listen, we want to invest in what you're doing as part of the Community Reinvestment Act to actually help bridge some of these gaps here. And one of the things is we got to get people to have a relationship with a financial institution, whether it's a bank or credit union. That's kind of a beginning step there. And these guys who are behind the eight ball and women need to understand that there are a lot of baby steps you have to take first before you can even think about home ownership or investing or some of these other areas.
And, you know, when we talk about building these relationships, you know, I kind of grew up and, you know, my parents didn't have a lot of money. You know, we used to hear arguing about the bills and that kind of a thing, but they were at least arguing about the bills. They were talking about it and trying to figure out how to get them paid and that kind of a thing. And when I went to buy my first house, I had somebody I could call up, my dad, who'd bought and sold three houses. Well, what do I do now? And what do I do next? And I grew up with my first bank account when I was a kid. That's not happening.
You know, I think when you think about African-Americans, you think about historically when we were free, it was like, okay, now you're free. But who taught us about wealth? Mm-hmm. We didn't know any of this. We knew how to accumulate, but we didn't know how to build. And particularly if you never get some of that role modeling, that's what you're talking about. If you don't have some of that role modeling, or the role modeling was very negative, then you're left to your own devices. So you got to really help people. And I think the problem for us as African-Americans is the lack of structure in the homes. There's been a lack of role modeling. And then really in terms of prioritization has not been where it needs to be in terms of that. We're getting further and further and further behind. I spoke at the Congressional Black Caucus event last year, and I addressed some of these issues. I said, we need to deal with some of these things. And sometimes we have to air our dirty laundry out if we're going to move forward as a people.
And Kelvin Schermerhorn, what about trust of institutions?
Yes.
I would imagine there's a pretty deep distrust. Mm-hmm. You mentioned how they were taken to there was fraud. How would you trust the bank? And once you gave them their money, did you think you'd ever get it back?
Yes, and I want to echo and say amen and amplify a lot of the comments here. So that's a problem, and it's a problem that's not without blame on the institutional level. We have some major banks who have paid hundreds of millions of dollars in penalties for steering African-American customers to subprime loans regardless of their income. And so this is part of the structural features of this problem.
You mean even though they could have afforded a less onerous loan, they
correct.
Still steered them? Yeah, gotcha.
Correct. And so it's lending institutions, it's real estate professionals who often make those decisions, say, okay, I'm not going to show this family this neighborhood, but I will show this family this neighborhood, and it falls by race. And to put some of this in perspective, racial wealth gap in the United States is widening. Now, this is not a problem that's slowly working to a solution. It's been widening since the financial crisis of over a decade ago. And just to put it in longer perspective, in 1953, the wealth gap was about 5-1. That is, white families had about 5 times as much net worth as African-American families. Today, it's between 10-13-1. And it's in part because of the financial crisis, African-American families had more personal assets invested in real estate. And so when the financial crash came, especially those borrowers who were in subprime loans, lost a lot more, and they had less going in. And then, as your other guest says, you know, the financial patterns tended to favor whites coming out of the recovery. People had more assets in stock portfolios, right? We remember the great stock market run beginning in the Obama administration, mm-hmm. right? So these kinds of things have real-world implications, and they are structural.
Kelvin Schermerhorn, we have to let you go. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Kelvin Schermerhorn teaches history, philosophy, and religious studies at Arizona State University. His 2015 book is titled The Business of Slavery and the Rise of American Capitalism, 1850 to 1860. We're going to continue our conversation about financial literacy in the African-American community, what matters, what doesn't. My other guest, Lawrence Funderburk, is going to stay with us for the hour. He's a certified financial planner. Maybe you've heard of him. He's also an Ohio State basketball star and former NBA player. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Jay-Z is the first rapper to become a billionaire, but he didn't get there rapping. Yes, his music is powerfully profitable. But getting to billionaire status had more to do with investing and building outside businesses for Jay-Z. Now he uses rap to share the wealth of financial literacy. And that inspired this program today. For many African Americans, financial illiteracy is a function of several factors, all of which revolve around the historic lack of wealth. We're talking about the history of financial literacy in African-American communities and individuals and organizations that are working to change the direction. Still with us is certified financial planner, alumnus of the Ohio State men's basketball team, and former NBA player Lawrence Funderburk. Rhonda Gaines is the lead counselor of the Housing Department for the Columbus Urban League. She works with the program for the league that employs financial coaches to help people learn to budget, manage debt, and establish savings. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Kimber Moorman is a teacher at Trinity Catholic Elementary School in Columbus, which includes, as part of its curriculum, a financial literacy program. Welcome to the show, Kimber.
Thank you.
It sounds like elementary school sounds like it's too young. What do you think?
I think the sooner you can expose kids to financial literacy, the better, just to get them to start thinking about it.
You talked about, Lawrence Funderburk, that people want to be able to touch and feel and smell it and have almost a tactile relationship with it. It helps them learn. So what are your thoughts about age and age appropriateness?
Yeah, you know, as African Americans, we're very tactile oriented in terms of, you know, touch and the power of touch, I think, is very important. I think it's never too early. I think you got to start with some baby steps. What is money? Why does money exist? You know, how should you use it appropriately? I think these are conversations you have to have 5, 6, 7 years of age. Hmm. But most of the conversations really are around money or we don't have enough. And when you think about that, you really have a negative mindset around money. So I always say when you come into money, there's one of two. You're either going to be very frivolous with the money. As soon as you get it, you're going to spend it, or you're going to be very frugal with the money. And that was really kind of my thing. And I think having appropriate conversations is never too early. But how do you have conversations where they're actually meaningful and actually allow kids to ask some tough questions? And parents, too, they got to be on this growth path as well, not just the kids. But sometimes when you're teaching kids financial education, sometimes kids have to go home and educate their parents on all these factors as well.
Hmm. What about that, Kimber Moorman? The parent piece of this, because the role models we talked earlier is another part of the problem.
What I've been seeing with the young people, they aren't given the opportunities to earn their own money or to you know, to have a real piece in it. The parents are kind of taking that away from them. So to let the students have ownership again and to look at decision making as critical in, you know, here I have this much money, what am I going to do with it? And how can I be fiscally responsible, you know, with that? And from our perspective, even giving back to the community, you know, with that philanthropy, tithing respect with whatever monies that we have, you know, that there's decisions to be made.
Rhonda, I read a great article by a guy, African-American guy, who wrote it in response to a question by a potential landlord looking at him and saying, how in the world did you get a credit score this low? And he kind of wrote the article and remembered everything that he did and all the decisions that he made. And that credit score, I frankly didn't even know about it until I tried to get my first buy my first house. But by then I'd been paying off student loans. I had, you know, good credit. I paid my bills, that kind of a thing. So I was lucky. But the credit score, what about that kind of topic? When's the introductory time for that?
I think as soon as ninth grade, to be honest, because credit is everything. Knowledge is power. Even if you're renting a property versus buying, when your credit score has to be a certain number. So I always tell clients that we want to, at the Columbus Urban League, we want to empower and not enable. Empower meaning by educating them, by letting them know these are some of the things that you would need to do. Now, when you're doing your budget and everything and so forth, your mindset is going to have to change. You're going to have to start changing a lot of things about yourself and be totally transparent about what you're doing. So I would say I would start with ninth grade, 10th grade, because at that time, kids are beginning to start thinking about college. And you mentioned student loans. I'm one of those people that took out student loans. And you never thought about, once I'm out of college, I have $98,000 to $100,000 worth of student loans to pay back. How am I going to do that? So I think speaking to the kids as early as possible and being transparent with children, letting them know, you know, what you're doing and make a game out of it.
But does the ninth grade age, does that presuppose that somebody like Kimber Mormon is out there or parents are out there kind of raising children up to that where it's not just a culture shock?
I think the earlier the better. Mm-hmm. But if you have not started teaching, definitely by ninth grade, the younger the better, because kids these days, they're on smartphones, they're using tablets, they can get the gist of almost anything.
And that's what
definitely start them as soon as possible. Make a game out of it. That way, once they get older, they know what the value of a dollar is.
Is that what you're doing, Kimber?
Yes. Yeah. The computer simulation games, in which, you know, it changes based on the decisions that the kids are making. And, you know, we're putting our money in jars, you know, at the fifth grade level, where they can start seeing the choices and the impact those choices make in a simulation setting.
Lawrence?
You know, when she talked about ninth grade, I always try to say your credit score is kind of like your report card. Mm-hmm. And it's actually more important. So I think whenever you can make it more tangible, more real. And I always say it has to be consequential. You have to make it some consequences. And if you don't follow these, and we know that historically in African-American communities, their credit scores is much lower. They did a big study in Chicago compared to some of their white affluent. And you say, why is that? So how do you actually get people to take credit seriously? I remember I was going in for a car, and I buy all my cars used. And I had a friend of mine, I told him what my credit score was. And he said, you got that white man's credit. And I looked at him like, what do you mean white man's credit? And he's like, well, your credit score is so high, it affords you this opportunity. You're exactly right. And you're punished when you have a low credit score. So we had a discussion about that. What is credit? Why do I have a credit score that's this high? And how can others have a credit score like this? But also we have to back up and say, what is the purpose of money? The purpose of money is a tool. It's just a tool. It's a tool used to spend, to save, to invest, to protect, or to donate. Right. And if you get kids, if you ask kids, what's the purpose of money? Kids will tell you different things. But a lot of kids, particularly our kids, will say money is to be spent. No, money as a certified financial planner, it's more encompassing than just that. So if you got to get kids to think about what is the purpose, and we all have a purpose. And if you think about the purpose of money, I think then that can direct you to your own purpose for your own life.
Can you talk about something as relatively esoteric as that when they're in grade school, Kimber Mormon?
I think you can start talking, you know, at their level. Those kind of pieces. They, you know, we've got to give them credit for understanding a lot more, you know, than they're given credit for.
My grandpa used to give us 50-cent pieces, which we thought was really awesome, and he would really not be happy when he'd come back to the house and say, let me see all the 50-cent pieces I gave you. And we'd say, well, I spent it, you know. And he would say, you know, think you kind of felt like kind of a loser around him. And that's how I learned that the accumulating wealth, like, would at least get my grandpa's approval. So is that what we're talking about, Lawrence?
You know, I think we bring in a lot of baggage. She talked about your mindset, and your mindset is very important. But I always say there's behaviors, there's your mindset, and there's your frame of reference. So your behaviors, your habits, they say it takes 21 days to develop a habit. Your mindset, three sets of 21 days are about 63 days. But a frame of reference, it can take years. It can even take decades to develop the right mindset. So if you don't get with the root causes, the frame of reference, then the behaviors are going to be very short-lived. And oftentimes we repeat some of the same mistakes as our parents. So if you talk about saving, that can be sometimes more of a fear-based model. How do you help people take risks? I think as African-Americans, we have an inherent bias or I guess a proclivity to take risk. But the thing is, how do you take calculated risks? Mm-hmm. And I think when you're at the bottom of the poll, you know, you can't go any lower than poverty. And I think sometimes the poor can actually advance up that continuum even more so than others because of their ability to take risks. Now, you just have to modify that where they take calculated risks as opposed to reckless risks.
Rhonda Gaines, when you're talking with somebody who's super in debt, horrible credit score, how do you help them establish that kind of relationship that, you know, as Larry said, can take months or years or a lifetime?
By being transparent myself, I have to let them know, you know, we all go through it. You have to change your mindset. And I think when people are coming in, a lot of times they're very prideful about what's going on. They don't want people to know that they're one paycheck away from disaster or their credit is horrible. A lot of people, they live in a facade that, you know, if they have an expensive car, they live here or there, they are living well, when most of them are one paycheck away from bankruptcy. So the first thing that we do is a pre-assessment to ask the client, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? And we talk to the client. And I think by being transparent, I let them know, you know, there's been times where, you know, my credit score was a 470 at one point. And these are some of the things that I had to go through. These are some of the things I had to change. Now, when you're budgeting, you're going to have to change a lot of things about you. For me, I love Starbucks coffee. I had it 3-4 times a day. I was addicted to caffeine. And I had, you know, to go out and buy myself a box of Starbucks coffee, bought me a Starbucks cup, and had the mindset that, you know, I may not be going through the drive-thru to get my caramel macchiato extra foam and whip. I'm still getting, you know, that habit that I want. So we talked to him about changing some things up, because when you're budgeting and you want to change some things about yourself, it shouldn't be to the point where you're unhappy with budgeting. You want to make it fun. And I also let them know that when you're budgeting, it's just like taking a trip. You may get on your car and put a destination in your car for to go, let's say, down south. There may be construction. You may have to detour. Same thing with a budget. Things are going to happen. When you do make a little bit of accomplishment, reward yourself. Be happy about the little thing that you've done.
You know, and Kimber Moorman, as far as you know, having kids understand, I've read about studies that show that people have a disconnect with what things cost. And I'm sure children would fall into that. I mean, how much does a car cost? Oh, it must cost $100, you know, that kind of disconnect. And it's innocent when they're children. As you get older, it's ignorance, and it can be very damaging. How do you talk about what things cost?
I think that definitely brings parents into the picture to get them involved. But, you know, through simulation games and different programs that we use, you know, they start to see a little bit like, wow, college, that's how much college is going to be. And if, and they pretend like they're the ones with the job and making the decisions. And I've got to choose this car, or I've got to, you know, take the bus instead. And when they're given only a certain amount of money that they have to budget and pretend to use, then they start, you know, little by little, they start to realize.
Lawrence?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And one of the things that we did with our kids, I grew up on generational poverty. I keep a food stamp in my pocket as a constant reminder of what poverty is. I always have this with me, and I never want to be disconnected. And if I am disconnected, then I'm not going to be able to help those who are trapped or stuck in it. My wife grew up in the middle class. She grew up in a small town, Chillicothe, Ohio. So both her parents, blue collar, worked hard. And then obviously we had children, and then our children was born in a totally different kind of category. But we never wanted to handicap our children. We wanted them to understand, first of all, what's the value of a dollar, and to understand that money doesn't grow on trees, and then to sit down with them and to go over, you know, how we spend money. We call it cash flow management as opposed to a budget, but let them see that this is real, that there are costs and there are repercussions, and get them to have some type of tangibility to it. Because I think sometimes wealthy families, particularly white affluent, they have sometimes kids have a disconnect because they're so isolated from the experience in terms of how their parents, you know, operate their financial situation. So whenever you can sit down and go over costs, it's more valuable, and I think it's more substantive. So that's why I love it. But I love what, as well as a guest here in studio, she shared that whenever you ask questions, you put people in the driver's seat. But you always have to be transparent. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key. Sometimes parents are not transparent. I always say transparency is the key to helping people break free. So transparency, when I'm transparent, other folks are transparent, that's a key that people say, you know what? I'm hurting. I'm struggling here. Thank you for being honest. Now I have some hope of moving forward.
For a long time in the big organized sports, football, basketball, they're now starting to respond to the need for more financial literacy among their players. These people with vast amounts of wealth, but they just piddle it away in a matter of years. And there's the percentages of players that are bankrupt within a decade after leaving, after being millionaires, is pretty shocking. What was your experience? It sounds like you're kind of, from the very beginning, you were frugal, but you must have seen that.
Yeah, you know, I think when it comes to sports, and particularly as African Americans, a lot of times, I use it as a hook. Sometimes I think the messenger is more important than the message. So kids will instantly listen to me because I played at the highest level, or mm-hmm. they'll listen to some entertainer. But then for me, I want to distance myself because I was an outlier in terms of professions. There are a lot of people who are very successful and do very well financially. They're just not on SportsCenter. Or they're not on BET or MTV or whatever the shows the kids are watching. Mm-hmm. So how do you get them to appreciate that there are other professions where you can be just as successful? In particular, with the professional athletes, a lot of times I tell them that one day the ball is going to stop bouncing for you. What are you going to do now? So I think there's a disconnect because really, you know, financial problems really are symptomatic of really personal brokenness issue. If you never deal with that root cause, you're still going to always be on that treadmill no matter what your situation is. So it just doesn't matter. It's just a temporary thing when you come into money. And I tell people all the time, you got to know who you are, just like you said, who you are, where you're going, and how you want to get there. That's what she just shared in terms of helping them when it comes to creating a budget.
And Kimber Moorman, before we let you go, just sending that kind of a message, what's that like when you're talking to elementary school children?
Oh, just on a lower level, but they can understand. And you know, like Lawrence said, parents needing to share with their children and be open and honest about finances and the reality of things.
Well, I want to thank you, Kimber Moorman, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kimber Moorman is a teacher at Trinity Catholic Elementary School in Columbus, where they include in their curriculum a literacy program for the students. We will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of financial literacy in African-American communities and how the subject is taught to youth. Still with us is certified financial planner, Ohio State men's basketball former star and former NBA player Lawrence Funderburk. Also lead counselor of the Housing Department for the Columbus Urban League, Rhonda Gaines. She works with the program for the league that employs financial coaches to help people learn to budget, manage debt, and establish savings. Nan Morrison is the president and CEO of the Council for Economic Education in New York. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
How does the issue of financial illiteracy among African American communities affect society at a larger level? Why does it matter to everybody?
It matters to everybody because everybody has an opportunity to live the life that they want to live. You might not be a sports star, but if you are fortunate enough to have an education, have a job, everybody has goals, you want to be able to understand how to reach those goals in a way that gives you a financially stable life. Everybody deserves that opportunity. And we have to reach everybody and provide access to the communities who don't have access. And the African-American community often doesn't have that kind of access to get the education that they need.
You know, in off-air, Lawrence Funderburk and Rhonda Gaines, we were talking about the trust in institutions and how that remains a problem because you said it's expensive to be poor, Rhonda.
Exactly. Because the interest rates are so high when you're buying things. Let's say if you do not have a bank account, you go to cash your check, you go to check cashers, you're going to have to pay a percentage just to cash your check. To pay bills instead of having that money direct pay out of your bank account, you're going to have to go out and buy money orders. So it is very expensive to be poor. Interest rates are higher based on your zip code for car insurance, gas, electric, cell phones. People do not realize how much more they're spending out per month than someone whose credit score is actually higher. So that's one thing we want to get out there. We do a model at work where we show a $200,000 house with the housing market booming right now. With principal, interest, taxes, and insurance, if your credit score is a 700 or above, your total payment is $1,100 per month. You can't even find an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment, for less than $1,300,
$1,400. And that's all, well, as soon as you get to the principal, that's all an asset.
Correct. So the most important thing is you want to have people learn about their credit. Most people that we see, once we pull their credit, they're like, oh, my God, I didn't know my credit score was that high. I thought, you know, my credit score was lower. And it doesn't take a lot to fix their credit. So, yeah, knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. I preach that to everyone. Please, you know, you don't want to be a renter for the rest of your life, especially with market rate in the state of Ohio. There's no cap. So you could be paying $800 one month. When your lease is up, that rent can go up to $1,200, which is causing the eviction rate in the state of Ohio to be, in Franklin County, phenomenal. It's 700 or more people per month being evicted. And out of that 700, about 85% of that is African Americans. So think about that. That's,
you know, Nan Morrison, only 25 states require high school students to take a personal finance class. That's according to the National Endowment for Financial Education. What do we know even about those classes and whether they measure up the way they need to?
Yeah, actually, the number is a little lower than that. A number of states offer it, but really only 19 now require it to be taken. And it's sketchy because we don't have, while there are standards established for what to teach and how to teach, not every teacher feels really comfortable teaching it. Most math teachers have studied math in college. A lot of teachers look like just like every other American. They're a little, you know, worried about their finances. They may not know how to manage appropriately, and they want to teach it to their kids. A study just came out that said a lot of teachers actually do teach it, and what they really just need is more training, more access to the knowledge themselves that they can impart it to their students. And it makes a big difference.
It just seems like such a basic skill. Lawrence Funderburk.
Well, you know, I'm going to show my age. We had home economics back in the day.
Right.
So you kind of had to learn. I know I'm showing my age
too.
Here.
Yeah.
And then they kind of got phased out. So think about this for a second. You know, you go to school to learn and hopefully go to college to get a job. All right. And then once you get a job, then obviously you want to earn some money. But no one ever teaches you along the way how to manage that money. I mean, which is really unbelievable. Right. And it's not a prerequisite because it's not a requirement because it's not part of the standardized testing. So teachers in our educational system thinks it's not important. So it's left to the urban leagues, nonprofits, churches, other institutions to pick up the slack when really you got 9 hours, 8 hours with that child. That should be really there, and it should be a priority.
And
it should be part of the curriculum standardized.
And money's so fundamental.
Yes. Absolutely. That's why I've challenged banks and institutions, insurance companies, all these. You have a part to play here, and particularly as African Americans, we're consumers. We spend more on average on food, clothing, and entertainment than any other ethnic group. So those institutions or those categories should be first line helping us in terms of bridging this wealth gap. You talked about credit. What about financial incest? When someone takes your credit score and uses it against you, that happens more so in our community than in any other community. And so we're punished by the law of compound interest, where it works for the wealthy, particularly the white affluent in terms of private equity and investing. It works against us in payday loans, credit card interest, all of this. So we need to flip the script and start using this as momentum in our community. And we need to start like right now because we're going backwards.
You know, this is Lawrence Funderburk here in Columbus, Ohio. Nan Morrison, are there other Larry Funderburks out there talking about this in other cities?
There are not only other people talking about this in other cities, there are teachers talking about this all over the place. I know you had a teacher on earlier, and teachers really love to teach about this. I would also say that he's right. You know, a lot of this is left to the not-for-profits, but we do a good job, and we do a good job when we work together. And we're really deliberate about targeting the right places. So my affiliate in Mississippi focused on some areas in the Mississippi Delta, largely African American, very poor. Here in New York City, we worked with the Cristo Rey schools, which target very low income African American, Hispanic students in a work study program. So just as he was saying, you know, we're giving them skills to go to work, we married up a financial literacy curriculum along with that. So these kids are going to graduate from high school, super important for success. They're going to go to college, also extremely important. They're going to have skills, work-based skills, workplace learning as part of that, and they're going to get personal finance. So they're starting out with a whole toolkit, not just one or two things.
I was wondering about that moment at Emory University when the keynote speaker, the speaker that day, surprised everybody by saying that he's going to pay off all of their student loan debt that day. Am I right about that? And do I have the right university? I've historically black college, Morehouse. I'm sorry, not Emory. Morehouse University and Morehouse College. And so and I'm thinking of that moment when all that happened and the shock that registered on everybody's faces in that moment. And I'm thinking, well, do they know what to do next just because they had the debt wiped out? You know, Rhonda Gaines, you saw that.
That would be great. I mean, all your student loans at that point would be paid off. So everything that's been.
But would you necessarily see that for what it is if you aren't ready?
No.
Right.
I would be in a heap because my credit score would go higher because my bills are paid off. The student, all those installment loans are paid off in full. And if I was not educated enough, then you could lose everything. Your credit score could fall within a matter of 6 to 8 months once you start getting credit cards, not paying those off because you're able to receive
those.
Oh,
the credit cards.
Yeah, the credit cards. Don't forget about those. Car loans. And most people, if they're not set up with a job, they're going to be living off those credit cards for the next couple of months. So without the knowledge, I think they wouldn't be successful. With the knowledge, then it'd be a whole different story.
I think one of the best things about if there was any silver lining to the financial crisis of 2008 was that suddenly I wasn't getting 50 credit card offers a week in the mail. Nan Morrison, that's me, you know, because I have good credit. Other people, what do you think are the hardest lessons to learn when it comes to economic education?
So I think the most important ones to learn are to pay yourself first and to understand the power of compound interest. Because if you pay yourself first, that makes the rest of budgeting a whole lot easier. And that's really hard. That's really hard. I was lucky in that my dad gave me that lesson from the time I was a super little kid. And even when I had student loans to pay off, he told me I had to start putting just a tiny bit away in my 401k. Mm-hmm. And that just becomes a habit. It's like everything else, like brushing your teeth. That's why we like to teach kids about this stuff early, to stop and think, what decision am I about to make? Is this something that's really important to me, or can I wait? And you know what? Even the littlest kids start to get that, because when they start to see in the activities that we do with them, the assets start to build up, that's a big deal. And this is a really important issue in the African American community and in any communities where there aren't a lot of that are poor, right, across the cultural spectrum. Because if you don't come from a family that has assets, you don't actually have the language, the vocabulary, the grammar to start to understand what you do if you're paying yourself first. You know, one young woman said to me, our family didn't have assets. What am I supposed to do when somebody says, well, now you can build wealth and create assets for yourself? She had no idea. Not her fault, right? But she's somebody that now has opportunity because she was at a specialized high school. She went to college. She had a great job. Now what? So we have to go back and start to give kids this language so that they can at least feel comfortable asking the questions and not have that fear or shame around not knowing.
Yeah. Lawrence Funderburk, what do you encounter on that score?
You know, I think that when it comes to language, kids can learn anything. Me, I've been doing this for over 20 years. And one of the things I learned is that rich kids and poor kids, there's really no difference in terms of their aptitude. The thing you have to do is you have to give particularly poor kids an incentive to want to learn. We're here on Ohio State's campus. A lot of African-American kids right here in Columbus, Ohio, have never been on Ohio State's campus.
Shocking.
So how can you tell them to go to college when that's too abstract, right? Mm-hmm. They've got to be able to touch it and experience it and make it real. And it's just unbelievable. So I don't like talking abstractly when I'm working with inner city kids, particularly African-American kids. I want to make it tangible and make it real, because when it's real, then they really get it. So we've got to really do a much better job in how we engage in these kids. And also, stop just doing, simulations. That stuff is good. But we have to take these kids out of their environment because that is the way they learn. I mean, there's Columbus Foundation here. We take kids there to the Columbus Foundation. We take them to five-star restaurants and let them eat in these restaurants. Not just a dream or a figment of imagination, but we're going to put you at a table and you're going to eat great food. And then also when it comes to investing, we give kids stock in publicly traded company. And one of those is Huntington Bank. The kids get stock in Huntington Bank, or we help them open up an account. This is how you make it real and you make it automatic, and you leave it. You can't leave it up for chance for them. You got to put them in situations where they're driving, and that's what you're talking about.
I'm going to add to what he's saying. Learn what your wants and what your needs are. Learn what that definition means, because that definition is not the same for everybody. Once you learn your wants versus your needs, when you're budgeting and you're dealing with your credit, it'll go a lot better. Because once you learn how to budget, you're going to ask yourself, do I really need this? Do I want this? Do I desire this? What are the consequences of me buying this? Am I going to want this 6 months from now? Am I going to want this a year from now?
The Marie Kondo of
yes,
finances.
Like, if I buy this car and I go out and spend $50,000 on a car, am I going to be happy 6 months from now? Am I just buying this to satisfy someone else? Am I doing it for myself? Am I being transparent? Am I being honest with myself? Where do I see myself in 6 months from now, a year from now? And when you think about all those things, when you're budgeting or making any type of decision, it'll help you better when you're making purchases as far as cars or homes or, you know, in that aspect. Because a lot of times people buy things just on, I got to have it. Just like you have to change the mindset. You have to change the behavior. I never had that. I want this. I got to have this now. I can get it right now. But what's going to happen 6 months down the line? Are you budgeting yourself to want something else? Are you going to be able to maintain this? You know, what's going to happen? So about the credit card thing, once you get your credit up, they're giving out credit card offers now.
That's
left and right. Yeah. And the interest rate on some are extremely high. Do I want this credit card? How much am I going to be paying back? You know, we do a simulation, a show. You know, if you borrow $1,000, you max the card out, you make the minimum payment plus $80 per month. Once you do how much you actually pay back in interest and you're paying over $60 per month, you're only going to have $40 if you do $60 per month for 6 months. That's $360. When you tack the interest on that, you only have, again, $60 available. So think about those aspects as well, where your money's going.
Rhonda Gaines, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate
your
time.
Welcome.
Rhonda Gaines, she's lead counselor of the Housing Department for the Columbus Urban League. And also, Nan Morrison, thanks to you as well.
You're very welcome. And Lawrence, I couldn't agree with you more about the need for experiential learning, taking kids onto a college campus, into a bank or a finance department of another big organization. We do that with Invest in Girls. We run a lot of our competitions on college campuses for just that reason.
Nan Morrison is the president and CEO of the Council for Economic Education in New York, and Lawrence Funderburk, certified financial planner, former Ohio State basketball star, and former NBA player. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's it. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.